Pseudopod, episode 200. Yes, 200. June 25th, 2010. This week's stories. Oh yeah, you heard me. Stories are Oil of Dog by Ambrose Bierce and The Horror of the Heights by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Welcome, one and all, to the monumental episode 200 of Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast that doesn't so much kill the monsters as set them up in a new town with a different identity and a job working at your local bowling alley. Seriously, we can do that. We know people. And other things. Your stories this week come from two of the greatest authors in human history. I am not even joking. Ambrose Bierce's body of work includes what may be the greatest short story ever written, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is a must-read for any Lost fans out there, as well as the still wickedly satirical Devil's Dictionary, and the staggeringly horrible story we are delighted to present to you here today, Oil of Dog. Bierce disappeared whilst following Pancho Villa's army sometime in 1913, and was never heard from again. Do yourself a favour, and make sure you not only check out his work, but the theories about what really happened. Your first story this week is read by the incomparable, the one, the only, the Lich King himself, one of the finest editors I have ever had the pleasure of working with, Ben Phillips. So stoke the fires and do not make eye contact with that police officer, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Oil of Dog by Ambrose Bierce. My name is Boffer Bings. I was born of honest parents in one of the humbler walks of life, my father being a manufacturer of dog oil and my mother having a small studio in the shadow of the village church where she disposed of unwelcome babes. In my boyhood, I was trained to habits of industry. I not only assisted my father in procuring dogs for his vats, but was frequently employed by my mother to carry away the debris of her work in the studio. In performance of this duty, I sometimes had need of all my natural intelligence, for all the law officers of the vicinity were opposed to my mother's business. They were not elected on an opposition ticket, and the matter had never been made a political issue, it just happened so. My father's business of making dog oil was naturally less unpopular, though the owners of missing dogs sometimes regarded him with suspicion, which was reflected to some extent upon me. My father had, as silent partners, all the physicians of the town, who seldom wrote a prescription which did not contain what they were pleased to designate as oil cane. It is really the most valuable medicine ever discovered. But most persons are unwilling to make personal sacrifices for the afflicted, and it was evident that many of the fattest dogs in town had been forbidden to play with me, a fact which pained my young sensibilities and at one time came near driving me to become a pirate. Looking back upon those days, I cannot but regret at times that by indirectly bringing my beloved parents to their death, I was the author of misfortunes profoundly affecting my future. One evening, while passing my father's oil factory with the body of a foundling from my mother's studio, I saw a constable who seemed to be closely watching my movements. Young as I was, I had learned that a constable's acts of whatever apparent character are prompted by the most reprehensible motives, and I avoided him by dodging into the oilery by a side door which happened to stand ajar. I locked it at once and was alone with my dead. My father had retired for the night. The only light in the place came from the furnace, which glowed a deep, rich crimson under one of the vats, casting ruddy reflections on the walls. Within the cauldron, the oil still rolled in indolent ebullition, occasionally pushing to the surface a piece of dog. Seating myself to wait for the constable to go away, I held the naked body of the foundling in my lap and tenderly stroked its short, silken hair. Ah, how beautiful it was! Even at that early age, I was passionately fond of children, and as I looked upon this cherub, I could almost find it in my heart to wish that the small red wound upon its breast, the work of my dear mother, had not been mortal. It had been my custom to throw the babes into the river, which nature had thoughtfully provided for the purpose, but that night I did not dare to leave the oilery for fear of the constable. After all, I said to myself, it cannot greatly matter if I put it into this cauldron. My father will never know the bones from those of a puppy, and the few deaths that which may result from administering another kind of oil for the incomparable oil cane are not important in a population which increases so rapidly. In short, I took the first step in crime and brought myself untold sorrow by casting the babe into the cauldron. The next day, somewhat to my surprise, my father, rubbing his hands with satisfaction, informed me and my mother that he had obtained the finest quality of oil that was ever seen, that the physicians to whom he had shown samples had so pronounced it. He added that he had no knowledge as to how the result was obtained. The dogs had been treated in all respects as usual and were of an ordinary breed. I deemed it my duty to explain, which I did, though palsied would have been my tongue if I could have foreseen the consequences. Bewailing their previous ignorance of the advantages of combining their industries, my parents at once took measures to repair the error. My mother removed her studio to a wing of the factory building, and my duties in connection with the business ceased. I was no longer required to dispose of the bodies of the small superfluous, and there was no need of luring dogs to their doom, for my father discarded them altogether, though they still had an honorable place in the name of the oil. So suddenly thrown into idleness, I might naturally have been expected to become vicious and dissolute, but I did not. The holy influence of my dear mother was ever about me to protect me from the temptations which beset youth, and my father was a deacon in a church. Alas, that through my fault these estimable persons should have come to so bad an end. Finding a double profit in her business, my mother now devoted herself to it with a new assiduity. She removed not only superfluous and unwelcome babes to order, but went out into the highways and byways, gathering in children of a larger growth, and even such adults as she could entice to the oilery. My father, too, enamored of the superior quality of oil produced, purveyed for his vats with diligence and zeal. The conversion of their neighbors into dog oil became, in short, the one passion of their lives. An absorbing and overwhelming greed took possession of their souls and served them in place of a hope in heaven, by which also they were inspired. So enterprising had they now become that a public meeting was held, and resolutions passed severely censuring them. It was intimated by the chairman that any further raids upon the population would be met in a spirit of hostility. My poor parents left the meeting broken-hearted, desperate, and, I believe, not altogether sane. Anyhow, I deemed it prudent not to enter the oilery with them that night, but slept outside in a stable. At about midnight, some mysterious impulse caused me to rise and peer through a window into the furnace room, where I knew my father now slept. The fires were burning as brightly as if the following day's harvest had been expected to be abundant. One of the large cauldrons was slowly walloping with a mysterious appearance of self-restraint, as if it bided its time to put forth its full energy. My father was not in bed. He had risen in his night clothes and was preparing a noose and a strong cord. From the looks which he cast at the door of my mother's bedroom, I knew too well the purpose he had in mind. Speechless and motionless with terror, I could do nothing in prevention or warning. Suddenly, the door of my mother's apartment was opened noiselessly, and the two confronted each other, both apparently surprised. The lady also was in her night clothes, and she held in her right hand the tool of her trade, a long, narrow-bladed dagger. She, too, had been unable to deny herself the last profit which the unfriendly action of the citizens and my absence had left her. For one instant they looked into each other's blazing eyes and then sprang together with indescribable fury. Round and round the room they struggled, the man cursing, the woman shrieking, both fighting like demons, she to strike him with a dagger, he to strangle her with his great bare hands. I know not how long I had the unhappiness to observe this disagreeable instance of domestic infelicity, but at last, after a more than usually vigorous struggle, the combatants suddenly moved apart. My father's breast and my mother's weapon showed evidences of contact. For another instant, they glared at each other in the most unamiable way. Then my poor wounded father, feeling the hand of death upon him, leaped forward, unmindful of resistance, grasped my dear mother in his arms, and dragged her to the side of the boiling cauldron, collected all his failing energies, and sprang in with her. In a moment, both had disappeared, and were adding their oil to that of the committee of citizens who had called the day before with an invitation to the public meeting. Convinced that these unhappy events closed to me every avenue to an honorable career in that town, I removed to the famous city of Autumnwy, where these memoirs are written, with a heart full of remorse for a heedless act entailing so dismal a commercial disaster.
This is Vintage Bias, where the true horror isn't in the visceral, gristly descriptions of the narrator's parents and what they do. Oh, that's horrible, don't get me wrong. It's massively horrible, and it's made all the more so by how matter-of-factly it's presented. But for me, that's not where the real horror is. The real horror comes from the fact that the townspeople know. They know, and they don't care, because when things get bad enough, you choose what you have to care about. And when they get that bad, your dog, your unwanted babies, they're surplus to requirements. Survival isn't always victory, and the implication Bierce closes with, that the only scars more severe than the ones the narrator knows he carries are the ones he doesn't, chills me. This is the real world taken to extremes, the simple, visceral desires of human nature overriding love and loyalty, family and decency, and leaving only a flash of heat, greasy smoke, and a child whose life can never be repaired. This is one of horror's truest, starkest faces. Our second story this week comes from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle really needs no introduction for Sherlock Holmes, of course, but his other work is often overlooked. Oh, sure, The Lost World gets trotted out every couple of years, but for me, the other Professor Challenger stories are much more fun, incorporating international science espionage, an incredibly early hint of the Gaia hypothesis, and what is for many a disastrous journey into spiritualism. Then, there's The Horror of the Heights, which is flat out my all-time favourite short story, and I cannot tell you how pleased I am to be reading it here today. So buckle up, check your oxygen, and make sure that the skies are clear, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true. The Horror of the Heights by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The idea that the extraordinary narrative, which has been called the Joyce Armstrong fragment, is an elaborate practical joke, evolved by some unknown person cursed by a perverted and sinister sense of humour, has now been abandoned by all who have examined the matter. The most macabre and imaginative of plotters would hesitate before linking his morbid fancies with the unquestioned and tragic facts which reinforce the statement. Though the assertions contained in it are amazing, even monstrous, it is nonetheless forcing itself upon the general intelligence that they are true, and as a result, that we must readjust our ideas to this new situation. This world of ours appears to be separated by a slight and precarious margin of safety from a most singular and unexpected danger. I will endeavour, in this narrative, which reproduces the original document in its necessarily somewhat fragmentary form, to lay before the reader the whole of the facts up to date, prefacing my statement by saying that, if there be any who still doubt the narrative of Joyce Armstrong, there can be no question at all as to the facts concerning Lieutenant Myrtle, R.N., and Mr. Hay Connor, who undoubtedly met their ends in the manner described. The Joyce Armstrong fragment was found in the field which is called Lower Haycock, lying 1 mile to the westward of the village of Withyham, upon the Kent and Sussex border. It was on the 15th of September last that an agricultural labourer, one James Flynn, in the employment of Matthew Dodd, farmer of the Chauntry Farm, Withyham, perceived a briar pipe lying near the footpath which skirts the hedge in Lower Haycock. A few paces farther on, he picked up a pair of broken binocular glasses. Finally, among some nettles in the ditch, he caught sight of a flat, canvas-backed book, which proved to be a notebook with detachable leaves, some of which had come loose and were fluttering along the base of the hedge. These he collected, but some, including the first, were never recovered and leave a deplorable hiatus in this all-important statement. The notebook was taken by the labourer to his master, who in turn showed it to Dr. J. H. Atherton of Hartfield. This gentleman at once recognised the need for an expert examination, and the manuscript was forwarded to the Aero Club in London, where it now lies. The first two pages of the manuscript are missing. There is also one torn away at the end of the narrative, though none of these affect the general coherence of the story. It is conjectured that the missing opening is concerned with the record of Mr. Joyce Armstrong's qualification as an aeronaut, which can be gathered from other sources and are admitted to be unsurpassed among the air pilots of England. For many years he has been looked upon as the most daring, the most intellectual of flying men, a combination which has enabled him to both invent and test several new devices, including the common gyroscopic attachment which is known by his name. The main body of the manuscript is written neatly in ink, but the last few lines are in pencil and are so ragged as to be hardly legible exactly. In fact, as they might be expected to appear, if they were scribbled off hurriedly from the seat of a moving aeroplane. There are, it may be added, several stains, both on the last page and on the outside cover, which have been pronounced by the Home Office experts to be blood, probably human, and certainly mammalian. The fact that something closely resembling the organism of malaria was discovered in this blood, and that Joyce Armstrong is known to have suffered from intermittent fever, is a remarkable example of the new weapons which modern science has placed in the hands of our detectives. And now a word as to the personality of the author of this epoch-making statement. Joyce Armstrong, according to the few friends who really knew something of the man, was a poet and a dreamer, as well as a mechanic and an inventor. He was a man of considerable wealth, much of which he had spent in the pursuit of his aeronautical hobby. He had 4 private aeroplanes in his hangars near Devizes, and is said to have made no fewer than 170 ascents in the course of last year. He was a retiring man with dark moods, in which he would avoid the society of his fellows. Captain Dangerfield, who knew him better than anyone, says that there were times when his eccentricity threatened to develop into something more serious. His habit of carrying a shotgun with him in his aeroplane was one manifestation of it. Another was the morbid effect which the fall of Lieutenant Myrtle had upon his mind. Myrtle, who was attempting the height record, fell from an altitude of something over 30,000 feet. Horrible to narrate, his head was entirely obliterated, though his body and his limbs preserved their configuration. At every gathering of airmen, Joyce Armstrong, according to Dangerfield, would ask with an enigmatic smile, "And where, pray, is Myrtle's head?" On another occasion, after dinner at the mess of the flying school on Salisbury Plain, he started a debate as to what will be the most permanent danger which airmen will have to encounter. Having listened to successive opinions as to air pockets, faulty construction, and overbanking, he ended by shrugging his shoulders and refusing to put forward his own views, though he gave the impression that they differed from any advanced by his companions. It is worth remarking that after his own complete disappearance, it was found that his private affairs were arranged with a precision which may show that he had a strong premonition of disaster. With these essential explanations, I will now give the narrative exactly as it stands, beginning at page 3 of the blood-soaked notebook. Nevertheless, when I dined at Reims with Caselli and Gustav Raymond, I found that neither of them was aware of any particular danger in the higher layers of the atmosphere. I did not actually say what was in my thoughts, but I got so near to it that if they had had any corresponding idea, they could not have failed to express it. But then they are two empty, vainglorious fellows with no thought beyond seeing their silly names in the newspaper. It is interesting to note that neither of them had ever been much beyond the 20,000-foot level. Of course, men have been higher than this, both in balloons and in the ascent of mountains. It must be well above that point that the aeroplane enters the danger zone, always presuming that my premonitions are correct. Aeroplaning has been with us now for more than 20 years, and one might well ask, why should this peril be only revealing itself in our day? The answer is obvious. In the old days of weak engines, when 100 horsepower gnome or green was considered ample for every need, the flights were very, very restricted. Now that 3,100 horsepower is the rule rather than the exception, visits to the upper layers have become easier and more common. Some of us can remember how, in our youth, Garros made a worldwide reputation by attaining 19,000 feet, and it was considered a remarkable achievement to fly over the Alps. Our standard now has been immeasurably raised, and there are 20 high flights for one in former years. Many of them have been undertaken with impunity. The 30,000-foot level has been reached time after time with no discomfort beyond cold and asthma. So what does this prove? A visitor might descend upon this planet 1,000 times and never once see a tiger, yet tigers exist, and if he chanced to come down into a jungle, he might be devoured. There are jungles of the upper air, and there are worse things than tigers which inhabit them. I believe in time they will map these jungles accurately out. Even at the present moment, I can name two of them. One of them lies over the Paris district of France, another is just over my head as I write here in my house in Wiltshire. I rather think there is a third in the Hamburg-Wiesbaden district. It was the disappearance of the airmen that first set me thinking. Of course, everyone said that they had fallen into the sea, but that did not satisfy me at all. First, there was Verrier in France. His machine was found near Bayonne. They never got his body. Then there was the case of Baxter, also, who vanished, though his engine and some of the iron fixings were found in a wood in Leicestershire. In that case, Dr. Middleston of Amesbury, who was watching the flight with a telescope, declares that just before the clouds obscured the view, he saw the machine, which was at an enormous height, suddenly rise perpendicularly upwards in a succession of jerks, in a manner that he would have thought to be impossible. That was the last seen of Baxter. There was a correspondence in the papers, of course, but it never led to anything. There were several other similar cases, and then there was the death of Hay Connor. What a cackle there was about an unsolved mystery of the air, and what columns in the halfpenny papers, and yet how little was ever done to get to the bottom of the business. He came down in a tremendous volplane from an unknown height. He never got off his machine. He died in his pilot's seat. He died of what? Heart disease, said the doctors. Rubbish. Hay Connor's heart was as sound as mine is. What did Venables say? Venables was the only man at his side when he died. He said that he was shivering and looked like a man who had been badly scared. Died of fright, said Venables, but could not imagine what he was frightened about. Only said one word to Venables, one word that sounded like monstrous. They could make nothing of that at the inquest. I could make something of it. Monsters. That was the last word of poor Harry Hay Connor, and he did die of fright, just as Venables thought. And then there is Myrtle's head. Do you really believe, does anyone really believe, that a man's head could be driven clean into his body by the force of a fall? Well, perhaps it may be possible, but I, for one, have never believed that it was so with Myrtle. And the grease upon his clothes, all slimy with grease, said somebody at the inquest. Queer that nobody got thinking after that. I did, but then I had been thinking for a good long time. I've made 3 ascents. How Dangerfield used to chafe me about the shotgun, but I've never been high enough. Now, with this new light pull Verona machine and its 175 rover, I should easily touch the 30,000 tomorrow. I'm going to have a shot at the record. Maybe I shall have a shot at something else as well. Of course it's dangerous. If a fellow wants to avoid danger, he'd best give out of flying altogether and subside finally into flannel slippers and a dressing gown. But tomorrow I will visit the air jungle, and if there's anything there, I shall know it. If I return, I'll find myself a bit of a celebrity. If I don't, this notebook may explain what I am trying to do, and how I lost my life in doing it. But no drivel about accidents or mysteries, if you please. I chose my Paul Verona monoplane for the job. There is nothing like a monoplane when real work is to be done. Beaumont found that out in very early days. For one thing, it doesn't mind the damp, and the weather looks as if it should be in the clouds all the time. It's a bonny little model, and answers to my hand like a tender-mouthed horse. The engine is a 10-cylinder rotary rover, working up to 175. It has all the modern improvements. Enclosed fuselage, high curved landing skids, brakes, gyroscopic steadiers, and 3 speeds worked by an alteration of the angle of the planes upon the Venetian blind principle. I took a shotgun with me, and a dozen cartridges filled with buckshot. You should have seen the face of Perkins, my old mechanic, when I directed him to put them in. I was dressed like an Arctic explorer, with 2 jerseys under my overalls, thick socks inside my padded boots, a storm cap with flaps, and my talc goggles. It was stifling outside the hangars, but I was going for the summit of the Himalayas, and I had to dress for the part. Perkins knew there was something on and implored me to take him with me. Perhaps I should if I were using the biplane, but a monoplane? That's a one-man show. If you want to get the last foot of lift out of it, at any rate. Of course, I took an oxygen bag. The man who goes for the altitude record without one will either be frozen, or smothered, or both. I had a good look at the planes, the rudder bar, and the elevating lever before I got in. Everything was in order, so far as I could see. Then I switched on my engine and found that she was running sweetly. When they let her go, she rose almost at once upon the lowest speed. I circled my home field once or twice just to warm her up, and then, with a wave to Perkins and the others, I flattened out my planes and put her on her highest. She skimmed like a swallow downwind for 8 or 10 miles until I turned her nose up a little and she began to climb in a great spiral to the cloud bank above me. It's all important to rise slowly and adapt yourself to the pressure as you go. It was a close, warm day for an English September, and there was the hush and heaviness of impending rain. Now and then there came sudden puffs of wind from the southwest, one of them so gusty and unexpected that it caught me napping and turned me half round in an instant. I remember the time when gusts and whirls and air pockets used to be things of danger before we learned to put an overmastering power into our engines. Just as I reached the cloud banks, with the altimeter marking 3,000, down came the rain. My word, how it poured. It drummed upon my wings and lashed against my face, blurring my glasses so that I could hardly see. I got down onto a low speed, for it was painful to travel against it, and as I got higher, it became hail, and I had to turn tail to it. One of my cylinders was already out of action, a dirty plug, I should imagine, but still, I was rising steadily, with plenty of power. After a bit, the trouble passed, whatever it was, and I heard the full, deep-throated purr, the 10 singing as one. That's where the beauty of our modern silencers comes in. We can at last control our engines by ear. How they squeal and squeak and sob when they are in trouble. All those cries for help were wasted in the old days, when every sound was swallowed up by the monstrous racket of the machine. If only the early aviators could come back to see the beauty and perfection of the mechanism which has been bought at the cost of their lives. About 9:30, I was nearing the clouds. Down below me, all blurred and shadowed with rain, lay the vast expanse of Salisbury Plain. Half a dozen flying machines were doing hack work at the 1,000-foot level, looking like little black swallows against the green background. I dare say they were wondering what I was doing up in Cloudland. Suddenly, a grey curtain drew across beneath me, and the wet folds of vapour were swirling round my face. It was clammily cold and miserable, but I was above the hailstorm, and that was something gained. The cloud was as dark and thick as a London fog. In my anxiety to get clear, I cocked a nose up until the automatic alarm bell rang, and I actually began to slide backwards. My sopped and dripping wings had made me heavier than I thought, but presently I was in lighter cloud, and soon had cleared the layer. There was a second, opal-coloured and fleecy, at a great height above my head, a white, unbroken ceiling above, a dark, unbroken floor below, with the monoplane labouring upwards upon a vast spiral between them. It is deadly lonely in these cloud spaces. Once, a great flight of some small water birds went past me, flying very fast to the westwards. The quick whir of their wing and their musical cry were cheery to my ear. I fancy that they were teal, but I'm a wretched zoologist. Now that we humans have become birds, we really must learn to know our brethren by sight. The wind down beneath me whirled and swayed the broad cloud plain. Once a great eddy formed in it, a whirlpool of vapour, and through it, as down a funnel, I caught sight of the distant world. A large white biplane was passing at a vast depth beneath me. I fancy it was the morning mail service betwixt Bristol and London. Then the drift swirled inwards again, and the great solitude was unbroken. Just after 10, I touched the lower edge of the upper cloud stream. It consisted of fine, diaphanous vapour drifting slowly from the westward. The wind had been steadily rising all this time, and it was now blowing a sharp breeze, 28 an hour by my gauge. Already it was very cold, though my altimeter only marked 9,000. The engines were working beautifully, and we went droning steadily upwards. The cloud bank was thicker than I had expected, but at last it thinned out into a golden mist before me, and then, in an instant, I had shot out from it, and there was an unclouded sky and a brilliant sun above my head, all blue and gold above, all shining silver below, one vast glimmering plain as far as my eyes could reach. It was 10:15, and the barograph needle pointed to 12,800. Up I went, and up, my ears concentrated upon the deep purring of my motor, my eyes busy always with the watch, the revolution indicator, the petrol lever, the oil pump. No wonder aviators are said to be a fearless race. With so many things to think of, there is no time to trouble about oneself. About this time, I noticed how unreliable is the compass when above a certain height from Earth. At 15,000 feet, mine was pointing east and a point south. The sun and the wind gave me my true bearings. I had hopes to reach an eternal stillness in these high altitudes, but with every 1,000 feet of ascent, the gale grew stronger. My machine groaned and trembled in every joint and rivet as she faced it, and swept away like a sheet of paper when I banked her on the turn, skimming downwind at a greater pace, perhaps, than ever mortal man has moved. Yet I had always to turn again and tack up in the wind's eye, for it was not merely a height record that I was after. By all my calculations, it was above Little Wiltshire that my air jungle lay, and all my labour might be lost if I struck the outer layers at some farther point. When I reached the 19,000-foot level, which was about midday, the wind was so severe that I looked with some anxiety to the stays of my wings, expecting momentarily to see them snap or slacken. I even cast loose the parachute behind me and fastened its hook into the ring of my leathern belt so as to be ready for the worst. Now was the time when a bit of scamped work by the mechanic is paid for by the life of the aeronaut. But she held together, and did so bravely. Every cord and strut was humping and vibrating like so many heart strings, but it was glorious to see how, for all the beating and buffeting, she was still the conqueror of nature and the mistress of the sky. There is surely something divine in man himself, that he should rise so superior to the limitations which creation seemed to impose, rise too by such unselfish, heroic devotion as this air conquest has shown. Talk of human degeneration. When has such a story as this been written in the annals of our race? These were the thoughts in my head as I climbed that monstrous inclined plane with the wind sometimes beating in my face and sometimes whistling behind my ears, while the cloudland beneath me fell away to such a distance that the folds and hummocks of silver had all smoothed out into one flat, shining plain. But suddenly I had a horrible and unprecedented experience. I have known before what it is to be in what our neighbours call a tourbillon, but never on such a scale as this. That huge, sweeping river of wind which I have spoken of had, as it appears, whirlpools within it which were as monstrous as itself. Without a moment's warning, I was dragged suddenly into the heart of one. I spun round for a minute or two with such velocity that I almost lost my senses and then fell, suddenly, left wing foremost, down the vacuum funnel in the centre. I fell like a stone and lost nearly 1,000 feet. It was only my belt that kept me in my seat, and the shock and breathlessness left me hanging, half insensible, over the side of the fuselage. But I am always capable of a supreme effort. It is my one great merit as an aviator. I was conscious that the descent was slower. The whirlpool was a cone rather than a funnel, and I had come to the apex. With a terrific wrench, throwing my weight all to one side, I levelled my planes and brought her head away from the wind. In an instant, I had shot out of the eddies and was skimming down the sky. Then, shaken but victorious, I turned her nose up and began once more my steady grind on the upward spiral. I took a large sweep to avoid the danger spot of the whirlpool, and soon I was safely above it. Just after 1 o'clock, I was 21,000 feet above the sea level. To my great joy, I had topped the gale, and with every 100 feet of ascent, the air grew stiller. On the other hand, it was very cold, and I was conscious of that peculiar nausea which goes with rarefaction of the air. For the first time, I unscrewed the mouth of my oxygen bag and took an occasional whiff of the glorious gas. I could feel it running like a cordial through my veins, and I was exhilarated almost to the point of drunkenness. I shouted and I sang as I soared upwards into the cold, still, outer world. It is very clear to me that the insensibility which came upon Glacier, and in a lesser degree upon Coxwell, who in 1862 ascended in a balloon to the height of 30,000 feet, was due to the extreme speed with which a perpendicular ascent is made. Doing it at an easy gradient, and accustoming oneself to the lessened barometric pressure by slow degrees, there are no such dreadful symptoms. At the same great height, I found that even without my oxygen inhaler, I could breathe without undue distress. It was bitterly cold, however, and my thermometer was at 0 Fahrenheit. At 1:30, I was nearly 7 miles above the surface of the earth and still ascending steadily. I found, however, that the rarefied air was giving markedly less support to my planes, and that my angle of ascent had to be considerably lowered in consequence. It was already clear that even with my light weight and strong engine power, there was a point in front of me where I should be held. To make matters worse, one of my sparking plugs was in trouble, again, and there was intermittent misfiring in the engine. My heart was heavy with the fear of failure. It was about that time that I had a most extraordinary experience. Something whizzed past me in a trail of smoke and exploded with a loud hissing sound, sending forth a cloud of steam. For the instant I could not imagine what had happened, and then I remembered that the earth is forever being bombarded by meteor stone, and would hardly be habitable were they not in nearly every case turned to vapour in the outer layers of the atmosphere. Here is a new danger for the high altitude man, for two others passed me when I was nearing the 40,000 foot mark. I cannot doubt that at the edge of the Earth's envelope, the risk would be a very real one. My barograph needle marked 41,300 when I became aware that I could go no further. Physically, the strain was not yet as great than I could bear, but my machine had reached its limit. The attenuated air gave no firm support to the wings, and the least tilt developed into side slip while she seemed sluggish on her controls. Possibly, had the engine been at its best, another 1,000 feet might have been within our capacity, but it was still misfiring, and 2 out of the 10 cylinders appeared to be out of action. If I had not already reached the zone for which I was searching, then I should never see it upon this journey. But was it not possible that I had attained it? Soaring in circles like a monstrous hawk upon the 40,000-foot level, I let the monoplane guide herself, and with my Mannheim glass I made a careful observation of my surroundings. The heavens were perfectly clear. There was no indication of those dangers that I had imagined. I have said that I was soaring in circles. It struck me, suddenly, that I would do well to take a wider sweep and open up a new air tract. If the hunter entered an earth jungle, he would drive through it if he wished to find his game, after all. My reasoning has led me to believe the air jungle which I had imagined lay somewhere over Wiltshire. This should be to the south and west of me. I took my bearings from the sun, for the compass was hopeless and no trace of earth was to be seen. Nothing but the distant silver cloud plain. However, I got my direction as best I might and kept ahead straight to the mark. I reckoned that my petrol supply would not last for more than another hour or so, but I could afford to use it to the last drop, since a single magnificent Volklang could at any time take me to the earth. Suddenly, I was aware of something new. The air in front of me had lost its crystal clearness. It was full of long, ragged wisps of something which I can only compare to very fine cigarette smoke. It hung about in wreaths and coils, turning and twisting slowly in the sunlight. As the monoplane shot through it, I was aware of a faint taste of oil upon my lips, and there was a greasy scum upon the woodwork of the machine. Some infinitely fine organic matter appeared to be suspended in the atmosphere. There was no life there. It was inchoate and diffuse, extending for many square acres and then fringing off into the void. No, it was not life, but might it not be the remains of life? Above all, might it not be the food of life? Of monstrous life, even as the humble grease of the oceans is the food for the mighty whale. The thought was in my mind when my eyes looked upwards and I saw the most wonderful vision that ever man has seen. Can I hope to convey it to you even as I saw it myself last Thursday? Conceive a jellyfish, such as sails in our summer seas, bell-shaped and of enormous size, far larger, I should judge, than the Dome of St. Paul's. It was of a light pink colour, veined with a delicate green, but the whole huge fabric so tenuous that it was but a fairy outline against the dark blue sky. It pulsated with a delicate and regular rhythm. From it there descended 2 long, drooping green tentacles, which swayed slowly backwards and forwards. And this gorgeous vision passed gently with noiseless dignity above my head, as light and fragile as a soap bubble, and drifted upon its stately way. I had half turned my monoplane that I might look upon this beautiful creature, when in a moment I found myself amidst a perfect fleet of them, of all sizes but none so large as the first. Some were quite small, but the majority about as big as an average balloon, and with as much the same curvature at the top. There was in them a delicacy of texture and colouring that reminded me of the finest Venetian glass. Pale shades of pink and green were the prevailing tints, but all had a lovely iridescence where they shimmered through their dainty form. Some 100 of them drifted past me, a wonderful fairy squadron of strange, unknown argosies of the sky, creatures whose form and substance were attuned to these pure heights that one could not conceive anything so delicate within actual sight or sound of the earth. But soon my attention was drawn to a new phenomenon, the serpents of the outer air. These were long, thin, fantastic coils of vapour-like material which turned and twisted with great speed, flying round and round at such a pace that the eyes could hardly follow them. Some of these ghost-like creatures were 20 or 30 feet long, but it was difficult to tell their girth, for their outline was so hazy that it seemed to fade away into the air around them. The air snakes were of a very light grey or smoke colour, with some darker lines within, which gave the impression of a definite organism. One of them whisked past my very face, and I was conscious of a cold, clammy contact. But their composition was so unsubstantial that I could not connect them with any thought of physical danger, any more than the beautiful bell-like creatures which had preceded them. There was no more solidity in their frames than in the floating spume from a broken wave. But a more terrible experience was in store for me. Floating downwards from a great height, there came a purplish patch of vapour, small as I saw it first, but rapidly enlarging as it approached me, until it appeared to be hundreds of square feet in size. Though fashioned of some transparent jelly-like substance, it was nonetheless of much more definite outline and solid consistence than anything that I had seen before. There were more traces, too, of a physical organisation, especially two vast, shadowy circular plates upon either side, which may have been eyes and a perfectly solid white projection between them, as curved and cruel as the beak of a vulture. The whole aspect of this monster was formidable and threatening, and it kept changing its colour from a very light mauve to a dark, angry purple so thick it cast a shadow as it drifted between my monoplane and the sun. On the upper curve of its huge body there were three great projections, which I can only describe as enormous bubbles, and I was convinced as I looked at them that they were charged with some extremely light gas, which served to buoy up the misshapen and semi-solid mass in the rarefied air. The creature moved swiftly along, keeping pace easily with the monoplane, and for 20 miles or more it formed my horrible escort, hovering over me like a bird of prey, waiting to pounce. Its method of progression, done so swiftly that it was not easy to follow, was to throw out a long, glutinous streamer in front of it, which in turn seemed to draw forward the rest of the writhing body. So elastic and gelatinous was it that never for two successive minutes was it the same shape, and yet each change made it more threatening, more loathsome than the last. I knew that it meant mischief. Every purple flush of its hideous body told me so. The vague, goggling eyes which were always turned upon me were cold and merciless in their viscid hatred. I dipped the nose of my monoplane downwards to escape it. As I did so, as quick as a flash, there shot out a long tentacle from this mass of floating blubber, and it fell as light and sinuous as a whiplash across the front of my machine. There was a loud hiss as it lay for a moment across the hot engine, and it whisked itself into the air again, while the huge, flat body drew itself together as if in sudden pain. I dipped to a Volpique, but again, a tentacle fell over the monoplane and was shorn off by the propeller as easily as it might have cut through a smoke wreath. A long, gliding, sticky, serpent-like coil came from behind and caught me round the waist, dragging me out of the fuselage. I tore at it, my fingers sinking into the smooth, glue-like surface, and, for an instant, I disengaged myself, only to be caught round the boot by another coil, which gave me a jerk that tilted me almost onto my back. As I fell over, I blazed off both barrels of my gun, though, indeed, it was like attacking an elephant with a pea-shooter to imagine that any human weapon could cripple that mighty bulk. And yet I aimed better than I knew, for, with a loud report, one of the great blisters upon the creature's back exploded with the puncture of the buckshot. It was very clear that my conjecture was right, and that these vast, clear bladders were distended with some lifting gas, for, in an instant, the huge, cloud-like body turned sideways, writhing desperately to find its balance, while the white beak snapped and gaped in horrible fury. But already I had shot away on the steepest glide that I dared to attempt, my engine still full on, the flying propeller and the force of gravity shooting me downwards like an aerolite. Far behind me I saw a dull, purplish smudge growing swiftly smaller and merging into the blue sky behind it. I was safe, out of the deadly jungle of the outer air. Once out of danger, I throttled my engine, for nothing tears a machine to pieces quicker than running on full power from a height. It was a glorious spiral volplan from nearly 8 miles of altitude, first to the level of the silver cloud bank, then to that of the storm cloud beneath it, and finally, in beating rain, to the surface of the earth. I saw the Bristol Channel beneath me as I broke from the clouds, but, having still some petrol in my tank, I got 20 miles inland before I found myself stranded in a field, half a mile from the village of Ashcombe. There, I got 3 tins of petrol from a passing motor car, and at 6:10 that evening, I alighted gently back in my own home meadow at Devizes, after such a journey as no mortal upon earth has ever yet taken and lived to tell the tale. I have seen the beauty, and I have seen the horror of the heights, and greater beauty, greater horror than that is not within the ken of man. And now it is my plan to go, once again, before I give my results to the world. My reason for this is that I must surely have something to show by way of proof, before I lay such a tale before my fellow men. It is true that others will soon follow and will confirm what I have said, and yet I should wish to carry conviction from the first. Those lovely iridescent bubbles of the air should not be hard to capture. They drift slowly upon their way, and the swift monoplane could intercept their leisurely course. It is likely enough that they would dissolve in the heavier layers of the atmosphere, and that some small heap of amorphous jelly might be all that I should bring to Earth with me. And yet, something there would surely be by which I could substantiate my story. Yes, yes, I will go, even if I run a risk by doing so. Those purple horrors would not seem to be numerous. It is probable that I shall not see one. If I do, I shall dive at once. At the worst, there is always the shotgun, and my knowledge of... Here, a page of the transcript is unfortunately missing. On the next page is written in large, straggling writing, 43,000 feet. I shall never see Earth again. They are beneath me, three of them. God help me, it is a dreadful death to die. Such, in its entirety, is the Joyce Armstrong statement. Of the man, nothing has since been seen. Pieces of his shattered monoplane have been picked up in the preserves of Mr. Bud Lushington upon the borders of Kent and Sussex, within a few miles of the spot where the notebook was discovered. If the unfortunate aviator's theory is correct, that this air jungle, as he called it, existed only over the southwest of England, then it would seem that he had fled from it at the full speed of his monoplane, but had been overtaken and devoured by these horrible creatures at some spot in the outer atmosphere above the place where these grim relics were found. The picture of the monoplane skimming down the sky with the nameless terrors flying as swiftly beneath it and cutting it off always from the earth while they gradually closed in upon their victim. That picture is one upon which a man who valued his sanity would prefer not to dwell. There are many, as I am aware, who still jeer at the facts which I have here set down, but even they must admit that Joyce Armstrong has disappeared, and I would commend to them in closing his own words. This notebook may explain what I am trying to do, and how I lost my life in doing it, but no drivel about accidents or mysteries, if you please. Hi, I'm Al. I'm 10, and I'm ill, and I'm in a bed which is twice the size it needs to be, in a room that wasn't mine up until 6 months before. It's late for me, which means it's about 9, and I really shouldn't still be awake, but you see, the thing is, I'm reading, to be precise, a collection of derring-do aviation stories, taking in Biggles, but more on him another time, and countless other heroes of the air. Then I get to Horror of the Heights. Then I get to the end of Horror of the Heights, and suddenly, sleep looks like something I might not be getting for a while. I keep thinking about the final, desperate moments of the pilot, about the awful, vast, magnificent predators of the skies that doom and eat him. I keep thinking about the world above my head, about velts in the clouds, about what happens in the places we don't see, what happens to the people we don't see again. I think about UFOs and ghosts and the carpet sharks that were in the carpet of my old room, and how it's a really good thing they can't get downstairs. I think about what it would be like to see one of those things, whatever they are, the things out in the dark, things I know are there and that I cannot see and cannot touch, but on some level want to. You see, I want to know with absolute certainty that there is more to life. There's something else. That Horatio's wrong. Except, of course, I can't articulate any of that because I've not read Hamlet yet, and, well, I am 10. I'm 10, and I'm horrified, and I have never, ever been more entertained in my life up until that point. For me, Horror of the Heights was patient zero. It was the start of a journey that would lead me up through the Alien movies, far too young, the Terminator movies, far too young, Haunted by James Herbert, the work of Poppy Zedbright, most of Vertigo's output, finally to the Scream trilogy, Buffy, Supernatural, and of course, here. To 200 episodes. 200 episodes of Child Assassins, What Dead People Should Do, Sentient Alien Cities, The Horror of Flight, X-Ray Souls, A Jihad Over Innsmouth, A Poker Game for Limbs, Graveyards of Ships and Ships That Are Graveyards, Black Milk, Medieval Soldiers Making Awful, Awful Decisions for Understandable Reasons, The Curdling of Family, of Self, of Soul, of the World and Everything Above and Beyond It. 200 episodes of some of the finest authors I have ever read. 200 episodes of narrators giving their time and their voice above and beyond the call of duty over and over and over again. 200 episodes of Ben, 200 episodes of Mer, 200 episodes of me, 200 episodes of you. And you know the one thing above everything else it's taught me, aside from that old line about never getting involved in a land war in Asia? It's something my 10-year-old self learned that night and that I forgot. Horror can be fun. Pseudopod, ladies and gentlemen, here's to it. We rely on you to pay our authors, cover our costs, heat the castle, and help us out with ridiculously obtuse eugenics-based murder cases in the French mountains. Now, we know, that last one's a little tricky, so in the meantime, how about you just go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. We'll let you know about the eugenics murders thing, though, you know, if we need a hand. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod knows.